This is American years. Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, and this is the 25th anniversary of Malia Mills, who manufactures swimwear in Brooklyn. We'll be right back. Malia Mills, we are sampling bubbly for your anniversary. Tell me about your brand. You make swimwear, obviously.
We do. We make beautiful bra size swimwear. So we're double A to G cup. Currently size 1 to 16, but very soon up to size 22, just in time for the resort season this fall, which we're really excited about. We started with swim because it was the early 90s, and the long version of the story is I had a friend who was my roommate in college who was currently working at the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Issue call me up and say, when I was working at my first job at Jessica McClintock in San Francisco, and say, this is a totally nutty idea, but I remember the projects you did in college. I think you should make some swimsuits for our next photo shoot. And I left my job that day, and I went to all the stores in San Francisco that sold swimwear. And it was like 7,000 million light bulbs went off. And it didn't make sense to me that the same size top was clipped to the same size bottom on the same hanger, right? Since you don't buy anything else that you wear that way. And rare is it that we wear, you know, denim pants with a denim shirt. And this idea that lingerie made so much sense, right? I could go from the swim department and then I could go to the lingerie department and I could buy any bra. And then I could turn around and I could buy any bottom. It could be lacy. It could be a boy short. It could be whatever fit me or fit the mood I wanted to be in. So that was really the genesis for the whole business, was how do we make swimwear that fits as beautifully as lingerie, is engineered as precisely as a bra, but cut from fabrics and colors and textures that you normally would wear in your own closet, and sold the same way you sell ready-to-wear. So if you just need a top, you just buy a top. And when I first started making suits and would tell people, they'd say, oh, what are you doing? And I'd say, oh, I'm trying to make some swimwear. I always heard, oh, hate it, don't want to wear it, need to lose 5 pounds, you know, haven't seen the sun in years or months or whatever it is. There was always this overriding feeling of somehow they didn't feel good enough to just get right in a swimsuit right then and there and go jump off, you know, the nearest dock. And I thought, we have to change all of that. We have to build a company that's totally, completely 2000% celebratory, from the products we make and where we make them and how we make them to how we sell them and how she's buying them and how do they make her feel, first and foremost. And that was really the driving force behind starting all of it.
So that was 1993, and no one else was selling different size bottoms and tops, which is almost unbelievable that wasn't a thing until that point.
Yeah. So you could buy, for example, in the J. Crew catalog, you could say, I want a small, you could pick from a set and say, I want, if the yellow top and the yellow bottom come together, I want the small top and I want the medium bottom. But you couldn't say, I want this top with this skimpy bottom, or I want this very sporty top with this
you couldn't
skimpy
mix
bottom.
It, mix and
you
match.
You couldn't mix and match. And the idea of engineering like bra size so that when we make, for example, our D cup Juliet, it's only going to fit a D or a double D cup gal no matter what size you try on. So you can't go smaller and smaller and smaller and think if you're an A or a B cup, you're going to be able to fit it. So that each piece we design stands entirely on its very own. So if that's all you want, you're buying something that's really just a little bit of magic that we thought really long and hard about exactly who this is going to fit and how it's going to fit and all the different ways they can wear that particular top. And then they can choose a bottom if they want or not, or go from there.
So you were in San Francisco in 1993 and you decided to start a swimwear line. What kind of learning process did you have to go through? How rocky was that?
The learning curve is still there. but I was very fortunate because I went to school up at Cornell and they have an incredible apparel design program where you learn about everything from chemical warfare helmets to scuba gear to tents and sleeping bags to lingerie and evening gowns. So the program was very diverse in what we were learning, but I think the foundation that I got there was, how does the end user, how does it impact her life? How does it feel on her body? How does the fabric feel on her skin? How does the seaming feel in terms of the support it's giving her? How does it feel emotionally? Does she feel like she's wearing a garment that's appropriate for where she is or what she needs to get done? And I think that really was the foundation for everything that we do, was this curriculum that I had. So I was very lucky to have had this design training and this product development training that was very end user based. So for me, it didn't seem unusual to go home and cut fabric and sew fabric and throw it on someone and pin it and ask them, what's going on? How do you like it? What's happening? So I think that I felt that there was, you know, I was very young. I had nothing to lose. So I felt like, well, let's just go learn by doing, right? And we've learned by doing pretty much every day still. When I moved to New York, it was 1991. So I ended up getting a job as a waitress. And that's really when the business was started. The first business plan I wrote in the basement of Odeon Restaurant. And I would serve up steak frites with a side of spinach at night. And then during the day, I would sew like a crazy person and dye fabric and cut pieces of swimsuits out of the headers that I would get because I couldn't afford to buy all the fabrics. And that was really the genesis of how the whole business got started. And, you know, I have to say, we give tremendous credit to everybody in New York, because everybody in New York wants to help. You know, everyone's here to hustle and roll up their sleeves, and everyone's excited to make introductions and to say, hey, you can do this. Or you really have just this built-in extraordinary community of cheerleaders. You know, the gals I was waitressing with, yeah, I'll be a fit model, no problem. You know, even Lynn, who owned the restaurant, had no problem with me using the computer to write a business plan, or, you know, would kind of turn the other eye and not worry when the UPS showed up to drop a box off while I was on my shift, you know? So I feel like there was this incredibly built-in support system from the friends, my family, my extended family at the restaurant, to, you know, even students that would read about what was going on and volunteer to come be interns. It was really quite magical.
So you continued on, you got into almost every major store, and then a couple of years ago, you got out of the wholesale business.
Exactly.
Tell me about that decision and what that's brought you to.
That decision was very scary. But I will say, like many of the decisions we make, we really do sit down and we kind of listen to the beating heart of what's going on. What's going on with us emotionally? What's going on with the city? What's going on with our consumers? What's going on with our team? What's just going on in the world at large? And it was just after 9/11, and our business was impacted, like all businesses in New York. It was really a crazy time. For us in particular, nobody was getting on an airplane. So what was a seasonal business became an extra crazy seasonal business. And we had to, since we were bootstrapping, we really had to decide, what business are we going to finance? You know, we can't finance both our retail stores and our wholesale businesses.
So you had some retail stores at the point where you switched off?
We did. We opened our first store, which is still open on Mulberry Street, just south of Spring, our little tiny flagship. We opened in 1997. And then we opened our second store, which was only open for about 2 years, the end of 1998. And then by the time we decided, oh, are we in wholesale or are we in retail, we only had one store. And then we had about 120 accounts we were in around the world, which was, you know, incredibly exciting. And I have to say, the wholesale business really enabled us to get the business off the ground, because just like when you get press, you know, when Sports Illustrated featured us or the New York Times wrote an article, when you can say we sell to Barney's or we sell to Neiman Marcus, banks want to take meetings with you and fabric suppliers want to take meetings with you and factories are ready to sit down and talk about how can we work together. So I do think, because we had this incredible support system that was helping us build the business, it was incredibly difficult for us to make this decision, because we had had so much support for so many years. But we really had to take stock of what was going on with us financially, what was going on in New York, and really what we felt at the end of the day was best for the women who are supporting our business. And, you know, when you sell to, for example, a specialty store or a department store, it's incredibly exciting. And it's incredibly, you're very proud of it. It's exciting to talk about it. But what was hard for a small business like ours is that the orders were always pretty small. So you're sort of spreading out a lot of small orders amongst a lot of stores around the world. It's from an operations standpoint, difficult to manage. It's very seasonal, so your cash flow is quite extreme because everybody wants everything delivered essentially at the same time. So you were always struggling to frantically run around and make sure you were packing up all these orders in time for an 11:15 delivery. And if it was late, they would cancel the orders. So you had not only a lot of pressure on your cash flow, but you had a lot of pressure on your operations because everybody on your team had to be focused on getting these deliveries out. So we really looked at, you know, our business was, we scaled back dramatically, and we really looked at what kind of manpower do we have and what kind of finances do we have and what kind of ultimately business do we want to build for our customers. And for us, it was really special to be able to go into the stores and meet women and have them tell us their story and tell us, you know, what they were looking for or why they loved a particular shape we made or why they thought a shape we made maybe could be made better. Or, you know, all this direct feedback, both from a product standpoint, but also from a how they wanted to shop standpoint. It was great because we would photograph all these different women, you know, all different shapes and sizes and ages, and we would put the imagery on our walls, and it was great to get the feedback. You know, when we were out trying to sell the business to raise money, we got a lot of pushback on the imagery. We had, you know, by and large, we were speaking to guys because that's really where the money was. And we heard over and over again, you know, it's such an interesting concept and I totally get what you're saying, but the models, you know, if you would just use, quote, real models, I think your business would do much better. And it would just, the hair on the back of my neck would stand up, you know, it would just make me crazy. And with even more conviction, I would run to our stores and we'd plaster even more pictures on the walls and in the windows. So, you know, when we would sell to wholesalers, we couldn't really get the whole ethos of the business out there. Ultimately, it became product on a hanger, even though they were incredibly supportive. It was hard to train the sales team in the stores that were far away from us, so that we had a hard time training them on the positive language to use and the no bullshit, you know, you can't look in the mirror and keep complaining. Like, we got better things to do. So let's find something that makes you feel like a rock star and let's get out there and change the world, right? We couldn't do it at the wholesale level. So we thought long and hard about it, and it was a big, big, scary decision to make. And we just said, we got to bite the bullet. We need to not sell wholesale. We need to start slowly opening our own stores. And once again, the city of New York was extraordinary because we applied for, the New York City Commission on Women's Issues had plastered on phone kiosks around the city that there was a grant to be had, and you could apply to win this award. They were celebrating businesses who were committed to supporting women in the city, and so we applied, and we ended up winning a first place prize, which was $30,000, and we took that, and we opened our second store on Columbus Avenue. So that was super cool.
It's helpful when the city gives you money.
Exactly.
Although sometimes it comes with a lot of strings attached that make it not such cheap money.
Yeah. Well, this was amazing. We got to meet the mayor. We got to meet other women who also had won awards, restaurant owners and caterers, all kinds of things. So for us, it was such a great way to sort of celebrate this new millennium that had just arrived and this new adventure we were going on after having run the business for so many years in such a different way.
So you moved your production to Brooklyn from Manhattan, right? Or did you start?
We actually just moved our, what we like to call the mothership. Okay. So our world corporate headquarters, we had our first one was on 28th Street. So after we moved out of my apartment, we had an office on 28th Street that we used to share with friends of ours who were computer animators. And there, one of their girlfriends built our first website for us in 1997. So we've actually been selling online for a crazy long time.
Wow. How did you even have e-commerce back then?
Yeah. That's crazy. Well, I don't know, but she made it happen. And my sister Carol, who's also my business partner, taught herself how to code. So once the website was up and running, Carol literally got, I think, websites for dummies, no joke, and pored over it and figured out how to create the code, if we needed to add a new, you know, image, or we needed to change the text, and if we needed to change the layout. So it was quite scrappy, to say the least.
Fantastic.
Yeah. To answer your question, so we went from 28th Street, and then we moved to 36th Street, and then we moved to 38th Street, and we were on the 16th floor. We had a really beautiful small office that had a corner windows that faced southwest, so we had really nice sunlight. We were right in the heart of the garment center, which was incredibly, just on so many levels, an incredible thing, because we had all these resources right at our fingertips, right? We had factories we could work with right there. We had suppliers. We could run downstairs and get notions. We could answer questions if things weren't being, you know, that the factory had a question about how to sew something together. So when we first started to feel the pressure of the garment center really shrinking, and a lot of our other members of the fashion community really talking about how do we make sure that the zoning doesn't go away, and we're terrified of the rents going up, and we fought the good fight for a long time. We would go and speak at community events. We would speak out by the on 7th Avenue, and finally when our lease came up and the price went through the roof, my sister and I just said, I don't think this is a battle we can win. I think that the winds of change are here, and I think we need to take this opportunity to maybe just shake up what we're doing. You know, as terrifying as it is to leave the garment center and leave the proximity of all these people who had been helping us for so long, we really recognized that it was a better use of our cash to go and save money on rent and go to Brooklyn and use that leftover capital to reinvest in the business. So it was terrifying. I mean, my sister and I would say we were the classic New Yorkers that absolutely thought the world ended at the Brooklyn Bridge. And my God, why would you possibly go to Brooklyn? And then when we did, we thought, what the hell took us so long? This is incredible. What a diverse community out there. All these new places, you know, all these new cultures to get involved with, and it was nice to have a little bit of elbow room and lots of sunshine so we could spread out and really think about how does the business operate literally day to day. And I would say, and Libby, feel free to chime in, but you know, we went from the luxury of having factories at our fingertips to having to sort of get our shit together because it was a 40-minute train ride to get in to visit them. So when we sent these lots out with the spec sheets, we had to make darn sure we triple checked that all the specs were perfect and all the sewing directions were spot on, and that the sample was exactly how we wanted the finished garment to look. And there was no, oh, well, if there's something wrong, we'll just run downstairs and make it right. So for us, I think it changed our business dramatically in the way we think about how to operate and really dot our I's and cross our T's.
I want to introduce Libby Mattern, who is your production director. Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Can you talk a little bit about what you have to do to make it work when you're not close enough to the garment center to run down the street?
Totally. So Malia's right. We did have the luxury of being able to, you know, really put out some fires pretty quickly if there was something totally gone off the walls when we were in the garment district. And that obviously shifted when we got to Brooklyn. And thankfully we had factories who were really supportive and great with just texting us if something came up, and I could hop on the subway if I needed to. But we really had to think about how to work creatively. So I would FaceTime with factories or send pictures where I had annotated everything that needed to be fixed. And it was, you realize what a luxury it is. I mean, we're obviously working much more closely with the factories than a lot of companies who are working overseas. But you realize what a luxury it is to be able to be in the factories in a heartbeat, you know, and fix something that needs to be fixed. But we have had the also luxury of having Frank, our cutter, in our office, who has been a tremendous help in catching a lot of mistakes before they get to a factory.
He's a master cutter. He's incredible. We've been working together since 93. Yeah, since 93. Maybe 94. Yeah. Anyway, he's incredible. He's taught us everything.
Everything. I mean, Frank, when I first handed him a cutting ticket 5 years ago, and there was, you know, something wrong with something on the cutting ticket, Frank just calmly took me aside and was like, just so you know, if I had done this, before I cut these and you know, cut hundreds of units wrong, let's take a step back. So he really has been a tremendous help. And now we actually moved our main ReadyTour factory into our office in Brooklyn. So one of our factories is posted up right next to Frank's. All we have to do is just go right around the corner.
So now full circle. We have one factory with us, and then a bunch of factories in Jersey, New York, Queens, California. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, most people, if they try to do swimwear in the United States, end up in Colombia or Brazil for manufacturing, but you're able to keep it here. I know there's some differences in the equipment that you use for like stretch fabrics and that sort of thing. Can you talk about what's required to be able to do it here?
Well, a lot of things are required, but first and foremost, we are diehard fans of Made in America, because for sure our business could have never gotten off the ground if there weren't factories right in our neighborhoods. And all the knowledge that they were able to impart as we sort of began the journey, and on the all the way, all the things that we learned along the way together. So it's not that we can't find the equipment, and it's not even that you can't necessarily find the labor force elsewhere. It's that we feel emotionally connected to the idea that small business is really the engine of every community, right? And we're proud small business. You know, it means that, sure, we can't grow as fast necessarily because we do invest so much into the sewing than other businesses might invest overseas. But it's been critical to really the ability for us to make change that we want to make, to continue to encourage other businesses that you can start a business right at home. And it's okay if they go overseas at some point, you know, maybe it's just the stepping stone. But without having all this talent, I think it's a missed opportunity for any community because it really does lower the barrier to entry. You've got lower minimums. You've got the ability to have personal relationships. You've got the ability to roll up and spend the afternoon with them, both talking about what you're looking for in terms of quality and also learn from them in terms of what's perhaps not as feasible when you take one sample and you turn it into 101. But to have that right next door has been critical to getting the business off the ground. And we feel like it's an important way to continue to give back to the community by continuing to support them.
So you have your sister as your business partner. What role does she play in the company?
My sister Carol would say she's the chief fire putter outer. She basically would tell you that she comes in with a big fire hose every day and figures out what's the biggest fire that needs to be put out. You know, it's incredible to have my sister with me because she's very passionate about not only the business, but also about new systems and thinking smart and how do we make sure that we're not working hard, but we're working efficiently. So she is very good at encouraging us to think about ways that we can improve the operations of what we do with still keeping an eye towards the beautiful quality that we want to produce, still keeping an eye towards the warm, hopefully what we believe is a fantastic experience in our stores and all the investment that goes into that. So she's very good at sort of balancing both sides. What are the logistics? How do you run it productively? And how does the business throw off enough cash that we can continue to grow slowly each year?
I often talk to emerging designers, and something I've heard from successful larger brand designers is that they had a business partner, that they were able to focus on the design because someone else was putting out the fires. And I often hear from emerging designers, you know, they say, well, what do I really need to launch my line? And I say, well, do you have a business partner? And they say, no. And I say, well, you should probably find one before you start down this road. Would you agree that that's a important part of it?
I think it's critical.
Yeah.
And I think what I think is critical about that is I think to take that almost one step further, we've always looked at our business, even as it's grown from, you know, my apartment to the first office, to the bigger office, to the bigger office, and then scaling back and then getting bigger and all these things, all these journeys you go on as a business owner, is we always talk to our team about everything you do is almost like running your own small business. And Libby can probably speak a little bit to that. But we really try to get everyone to think about their contribution to not just the task at hand, but how that impacts their teammates and how that impacts the business as a whole. So that we hope, one of the things that we are very passionate about is we want our team to feel like they can do it too. Like if they wanted to get up from their chair and say, you know what, Malia, I've got this super passionate thing I want to do, and I feel like I've learned so much that I can go and do it. That's the end game for everyone that works with us. So yes, you need a business partner, but I think it's important to also remember there's a business partner in all of us. And if we are curious and use all these amazing things at our fingertips, right? The people we know, the teachers we've had, formal and informal, the ability to go online and ask questions and find tremendous answers is pretty miraculous. So I think now more than ever, the idea of launching a small business is outstanding. And I would encourage anyone who wanted to start, especially a small design business, that don't be afraid to roll up your sleeves and pull all-nighters for a while and get it done and learn how to sew and learn how to sketch and ask people for help. People really want to help. And then decide, yeah, do I want to take a different route? Do I want to raise some money? Or, you know, how big do I want it to be? And, you know, clearly from our perspective, we love having a small business. We're very proud of it. And sometimes being small is kind of great. You know, you're pretty nimble to test new ideas. And when things start to go south, you can back it up and correct course. And we consider that kind of a luxury that we sort of try to manage the risk all the time.
So, Libby, in the middle of this, you started a nonprofit sewing school.
I did. So
can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I've been with Malia for over 5 years, a little over 5 years. Prior to this, I was managing a bridal factory. And about 3 years ago, I came to Malia and Carol and I was like, you know, listen, I want to open my own factory. This is kind of where I see myself in the future. And they essentially said, go for it. Let's see how we can do it here. What can we do in the studio and how can we expand our sample room to sort of help you get there? And so we started trying to hire people. We started trying to figure out what the process was. And there's just not a ton of sewers out there right now. And if there are, they are aging out of the workforce, and what's the future? So we sort of stopped, thought about what we could do as a greater whole, and came up with this program. So Course of Trade was officially launched in October of last year, but began about 3 years ago. So it's been a long road, and we've developed trilingual modules for learning and videos and partnered with our sample sewers in the studio who are incredible. They speak Cantonese and Mandarin and Spanish, and they've helped me by Olga in our office has been really great about putting on a GoPro and sewing for a day and letting me
she
just film everything
the GoPro on, her forehead
and just...
And then does all the processes, mm-hmm. the cutting, and then the sitting, and then the sewing, and then the reversing, getting up, and it's all right there.
It's amazing.
First-person experience. Yeah.
It's certainly a fun way to learn. And then it's been just trying to find the best community partners. So we've partnered up with the Women's Prison Association to help women who have some interaction with the criminal justice world to really start over and find new jobs. And one thing that we're really passionate about is bringing pride back into trade, because there is so much satisfaction that you can get from working with your hands. And I also went to Cornell, so I really did learn the sewing part of the industry, as Malia had spoken to. But I learned from my grandmother, who was really proud to be a sewer. And I'm proud to be a sewer. I know how to sew. And it's amazing to see someone's confidence build over the course of 120 hours in our studio.
And it's amazing because Libby often talks about how one of the greatest hurdles, and jump in at any point, Libby, is really the fear of, wow, it's a machine I've never been on, or I'm afraid it's going to not look right, or I'm going to sew it wrong, or I'm going to tear the fabric. So just getting over that and then just letting them just do it, right? And then stopping and slowing down and showing them how to do it a little bit differently, or, you know, how to get the measurement correct. And at the end of the day, holding this thing in your hand is really remarkable, you know, to go from, yikes, I'm for sure I can't do this, to holy smokes, look at what I just did, and hold it up or put it on or whatever it might be. Libby can speak to the first 100 bags as a way to pay for the paid training, the scholarship. So why don't you tell them a little bit about that?
So we have partnered up with a couple of places. So New York Fashion Made has given us wonderful grants to help pay for this is a paid sewing program. So, I mean, I couldn't take 3 weeks off of my life to go learn a new skill. And, you know, why should anyone expect to do that?
So they're paid to learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we have been also selling these first 100 bags. So it's bags that we make. It's the very first module in our training program. It teaches three different sewing machines and a bunch of different operations that they need when they first step foot in a factory. And then students make them. We hand stamp them in our office or at Malia's apartment.
This case maybe on a weekend when we're watching the World Cup.
Yep. And then we've been selling them in our stores, and all of the proceeds go to paying the wages for future trainees. So it's this beautiful little circle of, you know, selling and giving back and also helping the industry as a whole.
Is there a website for this where people can find out about it?
www.courseoftrade.com.
Courseoftrade.com. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Malia, where can people find your products? I mean, you have a store in Soho?
We do. We have 10 stores. We have 5 in New York. So Upper West Side, Upper East Side, down on Mulberry Street. We have 2 in the Hamptons, 1 in East Hampton, 1 in South. And then we have a store in Larkspur, just north of San Francisco in Marin. We have a store in Montecito, and we have a store in Santa Monica, and also in West Hollywood. And our website, maliamills.com.
Fantastic.
Where you also get amazing fit help. It's just like being
Christine
in a store.
Is incredible. Yeah.
How do you fit people through the website? How does that work?
Exactly.
Yep.
It's all kinds of magic. Christine's incredible. She's been with us many, many years. She started out in the stores. And then she went off and did a bunch of other things for a couple years and came back and is an absolute bikini whisperer, we like to call her. So when you order online, you can chat with her. You can talk to her on the phone. You can FaceTime with her to really figure out what exactly is it that you're looking for. What is your actual bra size? You know, a lot of women don't know what the bra size is. She sort of walks them through what brands are you wearing? What kind of support do you want? Do you want an underwire? Do you want not want an underwire? One piece, two piece? Tell me about where you're going. You know, is it a crazy romantic getaway or is it a family reunion? You know, it might have a different outcome. So she's really
depends on the family.
Yeah. Excellent point. So she's really, really amazing and has really grown the web sales quite remarkably. So that's very exciting.
Well, wonderful. And congratulations on 25 years in business.
Thank you. Well, we're excited for the next 25. You know, I think that Libby has really done an extraordinary thing, and it's really starting to help us evolve our business to have it be much more of an education-based company so that we can have all this knowledge, right? All the knowledge Libby has, that Christine has, that all of our team has to share and bring all of the, we call them mavens, all the women that support our business and shop with us, and bring them into the fold and have them share their knowledge as well. So stay tuned. We've got some really exciting things coming, including a new store in New York, which we're going to really kick off some of this educational programming that will be an extension of what Libby has started in the studio. So we're really pumped.
AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our website, AFPOD is our Twitter handle, and on Instagram we are at American Fashion Show. There's a Be a Guest form on our website. You can also give us feedback through the website, through voicemail at 646-979-8709, or by writing to info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. We occasionally do live events, and to get on the list for free tickets to our live shows, click the live show link also on our website. American Fashion Podcast is produced by the Fashion Media Center for Mouth Media Network. Listen to our sister shows, Fashion is Your Business, Material is Your Business, and Beauty is Your Business, also on Mouth Media Network. This and other episodes are copyrighted by Open Source Business Incorporated and Mouth Media Network Incorporated, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends, remain in force, keep making things beautiful, and keep listening. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.